Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome everybody to the Lifeboat Hour, May 8, 2015. We are so glad you joined us today. So jump into the boat with us, and we'll paddle for the next hour exploring new and old ideas together with a guest whose work offers us incredible buoyancy to keep us afloat. Before we get into the show today, I want to make a couple of very important announcements related to what our guest will be talking about and what we always talk about on the Lifeboat Hour. As I've said many times, the only sane response to the predicament facing our planet and the Earth community is deep grief. It's one thing to talk about news stories and the latest horrifying climate research and the extinction of species, and it's an entirely different matter to feel our feelings about all of this. The underlying feeling beneath the full realization of our predicament is grief. Now, I know that listeners of this show know that, but what we often lack is a place that is safe and supportive in order to feel our grief. So I want to tell you about two places for that that will be coming up that I will be offering in the next month where, in fact, your grief is welcome. One place is at the webinar that I will be doing with Francis Weller this coming Thursday night, May 14th, and the following Thursday night, May 21st. Francis Weller is a foremost expert on grief in this country, and he and I have worked together in the past supporting people in feeling their grief. In this culture, we are pretty much taught not to feel much of anything, and especially grief. That's why Francis and I call this culture a flatline culture, and that's why we decided to title our webinar Grief and Joy in a Flatline Culture. We chose this title because we've discovered in working with many people over the years and working with our own grief that when we can really feel our grief and be supported for doing so, our joy and our aliveness is increased. So in this webinar, we're going to talk about how all of us can safely access our grief and what the benefits of doing that are. We have a whole bunch of people registered already for this event, and we very much want you to join us. So to learn more and to register, visit syncast.net. That's S-Y-N-C-H-C-A-S-T, syncast.net. We want you to be with us this coming Thursday night, May 14. So after learning about why your grief is important and how to grieve safely and with support, the very next step is a weekend workshop that I'm facilitating in a beautiful setting in nature in Providence, Rhode Island, June 12 through 14. And this is a place where we can do more than just talk about grieving. We're obviously really limited in how deep we can go in a webinar, so this weekend workshop entitled The Gifts of Grief, Grief as Sacred Work, offers the opportunity to do together what really can't be done online. This is an amazing opportunity to come together with people who are very aware of our planetary predicament in order to share our grief in a very safe container where we build a community of support for grieving together. If you want to find out more about this powerful healing event, please email me at carolyn@carolynbaker.net. That's Carolyn with a Y. carolyn@carolynbaker.net, or you can send me a Facebook message, and I will fill you in on the details. I'd love it if you would join me for this phenomenal opportunity for healing, building community, and a deepening of your joy and aliveness. Now, one of the things most of you know about me and my work, if you've been following it for even a bit of time, is that my primary focus is on transformation. I personally believe that our possibilities for solving the myriad problems on this planet are very limited, but for the past 10 years or longer, I've been asking, in the face of the global crisis, some aspects of which could spell the end of our species on Earth, I've been asking, how do we want to live? Who do we want to be? Who do we want to be together? How do we love? How do we serve? How do we want to die? There are few people on Earth asking these questions, so when a friend of mine told me about the work of Dr. Mick Collins, I was intrigued. After watching some of his videos and reading some of his work, I realized that we are indeed soul siblings and that I needed to have him on this show. Mick Collins is an occupational therapist in the UK and, until recently, lecturer and director of admissions within the Faculty of Medicine and Health Sciences at the University of East Anglia. Mick's research interests have mostly focused on understanding the links between people's occupational and transpersonal potential. The subject of his PhD thesis explored the complementary functions of doing and being in the transformative journey through spiritual crisis. Drawing from diverse fields such as cosmology, new biology, and quantum physics, alongside depth psychology, occupational science, and mysticism, his 2014 book, The Unselfish Spirit, Human Evolution in a Time of Global Crisis, identifies how our global crisis is also a spiritual one and how we as a race can collectively grow our consciousness to solve the complex web of challenges that threaten life on Earth. As well as discussing theory, The Unselfish Spirit offers practical exercises and real-life stories, providing space for experiential reflections. Dr. Mick Collins, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
Lovely to be with you, Carolyn, and thank you for the introduction. Nice to be in the lifeboat with you all together here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you in the boat with us at all. Always a pleasure.
It feels good.
Thank you. In your book, The Unselfish Spirit, in the preface, there's a first paragraph reads, "We live in a conundrum. Humans occupy a planet whose resilience over billions of years is being tested. The planet, of course, will accommodate and live on as it has done for at least six times before. The geological and biological record contains evidence of massive convulsions in the temperature and chemical compositions of seas and air, which cause large-scale species die-offs in relatively short periods of time. The loser will be us humans. The conundrum is that humans have the capacity to remove the livability of at least half of their future population. They also have the capacity not to do so. The crisis of the Anthropocene, this new era of human dominance on planetary life support processes, is a moral crisis. It is not a crisis of resource scarcity, nor is it a crisis of ecosystems damage and debilitation. It is a crisis of greed, selfishness, short-term gratification, and a failure to learn from the most dispossessed, those who are best adapted to survive. Sustainability is examining our humaneness and our humanness, the subject of this impassioned book." So, Mick, I think that the two major premises of the book can be summed up as followed. First, we are facing unprecedented global environmental, social and political upheaval, and perhaps even the extinction of species, our own, as we destroy and pollute the natural world. And secondly, the only way out of this mess we've created is to wake up spiritually on an individual and collective basis so that we can begin to live a life in harmony with the natural world, an evolutionary change. And implicit in this change is the need to develop and deploy technology with wisdom. Please say more about this.
Right, thank you. That's just to say, the large quote that you read out at the beginning was the preface, and that was written by Professor Tim O'Riordan, who's a leading environmental scientist. And it was a privilege for me that he wrote the preface for the book. And I've been reflecting on that paragraph because I think it says more or less everything that we really need to focus our minds and hearts and souls for the job that we've got to do. And the thing that draws my attention is his statement that sustainability is examining our humanness. I think that's such an incredible statement, in that if we look at climate change, it's so easy to objectify it. We can start to look at graphs, the impact of some weather pattern in some distant offshore land or something like that. We can start to look at figures. We can look at comparative data from previous decades. But hang on a minute. This is examining our humanness. That's what we're doing in the present, not only what we've done in the past. And he talks about the way we occupy a planet. And I think I'm thankful to him for setting out the premise in that preface in that way, because the book goes about tackling how we're occupied in this current time. And, of course, technology, the question you asked, plays a huge part in that way we're living. But the book also then examines, well, what can we do as part of our humanness? And I was going to talk a little bit later on about technology, but as it's come in pretty soon, I'll just mention something that I think is important. The hallmark of this kind of modern age we're in, really, is very much defined by high technologies. We've got the internet, we have sort of all sorts of devices that are just overtaking sometimes our capacities. As you know, this is my first foray into Skype, and when you said we'd be talking on Skype, I had a minor panic attack. So I'm a technophobe. But if we look at the word techne, it's a Greek word, and I'm always reminded of the really good Jungian analyst Thomas More, who talks about techne to bio. That's a Greek word for the craft of life. And it has a natural correlation to caring for the soul. So techne is never divorced from who we are at the deepest levels of our being and how we live our life. So naturally, for me, when I think of technology, I think about how are we crafting our lives? How are we living? What resources are we using? Let's be clear. When we were early hominids, Australopithecus afarensis, many, many millions of years ago, we had rudimentary tools like pebble choppers for cutting. That was a technology. It's not only about wires and wirelesses and Wi-Fis. Technologies are the things that we evolve with the way that we're living our lives. So for me, the really interesting question is, how are we crafting our lives in a soulful way and using technologies to express and connect with life in meaningful ways? It naturally ties in for me some technologies that are not getting as much airtime as I would like to see, is technologies of transcendence. We have countless years and millennia of disciplines of yoga and meditation and shamanism and all sorts of inner work, Jungian psychology, this evolution of technologies of transcendence. How are we employing those technologies in line of the techne to bio, the craft of life? To me, that's a soulful question, and I think that's part of this conundrum of examining our humanness. It would be so easy for us to just think that the modern problems we're facing are going to be technologically crafted. I don't think so. It's going to be about how we soulfully engage technologies to craft a way of life that connects to ourselves in meaningful ways, to others and other species, and nature as a whole. That's a whole new ball game, and I'm quite excited by that proposition, but also a bit frustrated because we seem to be a bit slow getting there.
Well, I totally agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more, and listeners to this show really appreciate what you're saying. Now, you're a wordsmith, obviously, and so you have a website named Epic Zoetic, and yes, that is spelled E-P-I-C-Z-O-E-T-I-C. It's epiczoetic.co.uk. What does that mean, and why did you choose the name?
Well, it's funny. I've got a real quirk with words. I do enjoy words, and I like words that make me pay attention. So if I see something in the city, an advertisement on the side of a bus, it can take me off into places where I never thought I'd ever go. You know,
I can appreciate that.
In London, we have these double-decker buses with adverts on the side, and sometimes they're almost like lovely messages to just enrich your life, and sometimes they're not. But right. Words are fantastic. So epic for me was something that I crafted in light of having an acronym. And so for me, epic ties in with the fact that it's a journey. Epic means something that really is a task to be faced, but a rite of passage. So I thought, well, that seems to be the right word for these times. And the way that I sort of broke down the word epic was to think about the qualities within that epic journey. So I thought about qualities of experience, qualities of participation, qualities of intelligence, and qualities of consciousness. And I thought about those EPIC, epic qualities that we would possibly be drawing on to face this monumental time to manage this crisis. But then I thought epic just sounds a little bit flat. And so I started going through my thesaurus, and as usual, words pop out, and the word zoetic popped up. And I loved it because the synonyms for zoetic are being awake, being aware, being alive, being fulfilled. So really embracing the journey in a nourishing, flourishing kind of way. So epic, zoetic, and it also sounded like poetic. And yeah. I thought, oh, this is good. I like it. So everybody said, oh, you're nuts. It's too long and nobody will understand it. And I said, well, I don't care. It means something to me. So I stuck with it.
Well, speaking of journeys, you've done many things in your life, including leaving school at 15 and traveling. You did a lot of blue-collar type things until living with the Buddhists for a while seemed to help you find your right livelihood. And you said this led you into a passion for spirituality. Tell us a bit about your journey.
Well, yes, a very what I'd call almost dissociated and disconnected lifestyle, really. I grew up in a military family. I was adopted into that family, and my adopted parents had no extended family, so we moved all around the world. So I had actually was very much on my own as an only child with a family that had no extended family who weren't really my own family. And so it was quite an interesting existence. I didn't realize, you know, that people would go off and see distant aunts and uncles and cousins. I had no idea what that meant. But I didn't get on with education because I never stayed in a school long enough to learn anything. So, you know, I was a natural dreamer, which has profited me enormously ever since. But I left school at 15 because it was a hopeless task trying to you know, different schools. They didn't have a national curriculum in them days. So you went to one school and they'd be halfway through teaching something which I had no idea what they were talking about. So... So I left school at 15. I got in trouble with the police quite a lot between 15 and 17, so I was a bit wild and not a very pleasant character, I don't think, really. But I joined the infantry in the army in 1974 to try and straighten my life a little bit and get some discipline. And then after 3.5 years, I left and spent 6 years traveling on the road. Sort of, it was in the mid-70s, so I grew my hair and, you know, ran free, just really picked up that spirit of adventure. And then after that, I ended up in 1983-84 in a Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist monastery for 3 years. And that's where I started to deepen my sense of what's this all about, what's life about, and asking bigger questions. At the time, I also had a Kundalini awakening experience due to the tantric meditations, and I had no idea what was happening, so I kind of got thrown right off the path in a state of crisis, and I had to spend a couple of years putting myself together again. So that was a pretty crazy hiatus, But after being unemployed for some time, I then decided, once I started to get myself back together again, to start looking at gaining an education. So I did a diploma in health studies about 1989, and then started to work towards becoming an occupational therapist and somebody who was interested in transpersonal psychology. So it's been a very much an individuating path of finding self and going through all sorts of manner of crazy times, but very rich and rewarding whilst also painful and exposing, I would say.
Well, thank you for that little saga through your life. And I want to invite people to check out Nick's website at www.epiczoetic, that's spelled epiczoetic.co.uk. It's a beautiful site, and you can see a video of Mick on that site as well as a couple of other videos of him on YouTube. Now, in a while, we're going to open the lines for callers to come and give us some questions or comments about anything that Mick is saying. We're at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. So, Mick, in our work, we both use the word transformation. What does that word mean to you?
Well, I think that's a lovely question, actually, because to me, it's the heart of what it means to be a human. And before I answer that question, do you mind if I just put a bit of context onto that?
Sure, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, we've sort of established that we've got a time of global crisis that we're in. And one of the things that I suppose if I'm critical of my own culture and my own cultural institutions and social institutions to which I belong, I believe there's been a collective underinvestment in our human potential in terms of who we are. We're sort of often sort of turning up at work and going to school and in education and all those sorts of arenas where we meet with others, unless, of course, you're in the Naropa Institute or the California Institute of Integral Studies. You're lucky because people are going to be talking about transformation there. But if you're working in a big insurance company or even a university, you might find that those conversations are rare. And to me, there's something in that which I feel a little bit concerned about, in that I believe we're tethered to an outmoded view of consciousness. We've got this sort of ego ideal that somehow the ego is the center of consciousness, and all we have to do is be reasonably well adapted socially and to have a sense of social understanding, the social mores, and taking care of ourselves in that way and respecting others, which of course is right, that somehow we're fine, we're done. The next thing is to get a good career and earn some money and you're okay. Well, I really do feel that's less than satisfactory personally. And I'd like to see a much more holistic view of the psyche, as sort of put forward by Carl Jung and the transpersonalists, to try and look at stretching out this idea of who we are and being more expansive in our social institutions, in the way we educate children, in the way we take our opportunities at work and develop ourselves or further study. So putting that context onto the idea of transformation was important for me because I don't think it's a given. I think it's great when you meet people like yourself who are doing great work and running sessions for people. But I'm also feeling for all those people that are in systems that offer few opportunities or people not having many financial means to support their journeys of transformation. So I'd like to see more of that in a human resources department in a business. That would be amazing. So for me, the word transformation, well, I write about that in my book. And I think about the idea of, because in the word transformation is the word form. And we live and work in forms, social forms, and all these different areas and arenas that we work in. But I also write about flow, because I don't think transformation's fixed. Clearly, transforming is about being more fluid and more engaged in living our potential. So there's a few things that I think about the word transformation, and one of them starts with at least having a sense of trajectory, a sense of direction in our life, that we are aiming to try and find out more about who we are. And I heard you mention the workshops that you're running to look at those issues, which sounds great. But it includes meeting edges and thresholds and how we consider new possibilities and what they may be. So there's a real invitation there to start looking at what transformation could mean in terms of possibilities. And making those transitions in new ways of living. So, you know, finding opportunities to really express this potential that's being brought forth. And finally, I think it's about transcending. There's something about transcendence in transformation that we jettison our outmoded attitudes and actions and behaviors that no longer serve us. So there's something very dynamic about transformation, which if as a society we embraced these ideas more in our working practices, in our educational practices, I think we'd all be enriched by it. And I'm one of those people at work who will often listen to people's dreams or hear a story about someone who's struggled, or go out in a field on campus and sit and chat about a possibility with someone, because I value that. And, you know, so I know that actually many people are willing to do this who wouldn't be identified as transformers. So my question is, why are we so one-dimensional as a whole, as a society, and why have we invested so much in this ego ideal, which is so limiting? It's there to serve. It's not the be-all and end-all of existence. It's just something that we need to function in our social routines. So for me, transformation is enormous, and I think it underpins everything about what you're doing in your work and what I feel connected to in my work. But this is something we need to open up these questions much more in the collective.
Well, thank you for that. And I'm going to skip the question I was going to ask you next and maybe come back to it because I want to go to the next one, because the next question is so related to what you just said. Uh-huh. Many people have difficulty with the word spiritual or spirituality, and I'm very sure that for you it has nothing to do with religion. But I'd like you to define what spirituality means to you and also talk about your two broad categories of spiritual emergence and spiritual emergency.
Sure. And yes, it's interesting because I don't necessarily belong to any religion. But I'm always reading books about religion, and I'm currently reading the life biography of St. Francis of Assisi and St. Monica, who is the mother of St. Augustine. And, she was living a life of perpetual prayer, apparently, to try and get her wayward son back on the path. She obviously did a good job, because he ended up being a very fine scholar and spiritual teacher. But so I'm always interested in religion, but I wouldn't be necessarily bound by any religion. So I always like, I've read Karen Armstrong's work when she talks about the shift in the axial age, where, you know, you've got things like Buddhism and Christianity and all those great religions, and how compassion was trying to flower in the collective, and, you know, wonderful to read about that. But somehow at the moment, I think religion is testing us, because if we just fall into camps of your religion, my religion, and without reaching out and connecting to one another, I think that's going to be problematic. So we need a sort of a meta view, a meta spirituality, which can embrace all these different spiritual stroke religious impulses, paths, or whatever you want to call them. So for me, not being a specific religious devotee of any kind, one word that springs to mind that I do hold close to my heart is the word the numinous. And this is a word that was put together by Rudolf Otto. And he wrote a book called The Idea of the Holy. And essentially what the numinous refers to is that somehow there's a mystery in life of which we can be part of, which permeates our being from time to time. Not always. a mystical experience would be a good illustration of when the numinous touches us. And so I kind of like the idea that there's this, Rudolf Otto called it the holy other. And there's something for me there about, here I am in my skin-encapsulated ego, getting on with my life, but I'm permeable to these direct experiences and encounters, which can enliven my soul and give me a whole new sense of meaning and wonder and awe. These are the sort of words that go with the numinous. And so it's no surprise that for me, the numinous was something that was very close to the heart of Carl Jung. He was very taken with this idea. And of course, that really catalyzes when we get in touch with these numinous processes. He would say, for instance, the focus of my work is not pathology, but it's about how to get closer to the numinous and how to be enlivened by that type of encounter. So I got very taken with this idea of the numinous being close to us. And I guess the natural link there is that when the numinous is encountered, it affects and shifts our consciousness in some way. We're opened up to something bigger. Now, people can have words for that, like God or a great being or the moksha, nirvana, whatever you want to call it. But the fact is, it happens. It's an experience or an encounter. So for me, there's a natural link then to the words spiritual emergence and spiritual emergency. And I wrote about this in the book and in a previous paper, where when we have contact with the numinous, let's say on a meditation retreat or a prayer session or a contemplation in nature, we can have that sort of beatific moment with the numinous where we have an almost poetic encounter which brings peace and harmony in our experience, and we feel at one with life and tranquil and joyful and awestruck. And that's where I think the numinous touches us in relation to spiritual emergence, and it helps our sense of self to just it be enriched and grow and nurtured by those experiences. But there's another side to the numinous. It can be it can come upon us rather abruptly, very quickly, and it can be experienced as something like a rapid awakening, which is overpowering and frightening. And then we're not in a comfortable sort of place with it, and we're then really jumbled up and everything's up in the air. We have to then try and work out what's going on and find our way through it. Now, Jung would be equal to either of those two processes. Indeed, he went through very similar experiences himself. In his red book, he talks about having a real encounter with the soul and, waking up and going through. What he said was at times potentially almost bordering on a psychosis, but he always managed to hold it together. But I'd say that was his spiritual emergency that he was having. But what's wonderful about this is that we're being opened up in sometimes very nice ways and very pleasant ways, and sometimes ways that are a bit scary. But the way that we're awoken, if you wish, is where we start to individuate and integrate those experiences. Then we're living closer to that ego and the self with a capital S, that ego-self connection. And so for me, the whole spiritual journey as a psycho-spiritual growth individuation path is, if you wish, somehow not necessarily always activated, but punctuated at times by numinous experiences. I don't know if that answers the question.
Well, it does, and it's going to lead us into a couple of minutes of singing. We're going to pause here and listen to a song. This is an oldie from about 20 years ago, but still one of my favorites, and it resonates so beautifully with your work, Mick, and takes us close to the land where you live. Here's How Can I Keep From Singing by Enya.
My life goes on in endless.
Since love is Lord of heaven and earth, how can I keep from singing? That was How Can I Keep From Singing by Enya, and this is the Lifeboat Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker, and I'm honored today to be talking with Dr. Mick Collins, author of The Unselfish Spirit, Human Evolution in a Time of Global Crisis. You can find all of his work at epiczoetic.co.uk. And we're going to open the lines now to callers. We would love it if you'd call us at 888-874-4888 with a question or a comment for Dr. Collins. You know, I've been thinking, Mick, as we've been talking, and after the last question, I just kind of want to throw this in spontaneously, that that what we seem to be in right now is a planetary spiritual emergency. What do you think about that?
I totally agree with you. And there's some nice work by Catherine Lucas, and she talks about not only the dark night of the soul, but the dark night of the globe. And I thought that was a rather beautiful way to illustrate the situation we're in. And of course, my thoughts about that are that we've because of our one-sidedness and our ego ideal and not connecting to our full potential and how we're embedded in a greater life, a greater field of consciousness, we've taken the world for granted, and we have finite resources. They're not going to be around forever. And so we need to really develop a sense of stewardship, a sense of wise use of our resources, and to really look after the Earth and this planet as if it were a soul. You know, the anima mundi, Jung called the soul of the world. You know, that trees are sacred, animals are sacred. Everything has a sacredness to it, and I think we've lost that, and I think we're getting it back. With our connections to the indigenous cultures who are teaching us and reminding us what they've never forgotten.
Well, I agree. And I think that, you know, one of the things Jung talked about a great deal and that I talk about in my work, and you spoke of the indigenous cultures, is that whole notion of initiation, a rite of passage. And more and more, I feel that we are, as a species, as an Earth community, going through a rite of passage, a planetary initiation.
Yes.
And, you know, with initiations, there aren't any guarantees that people will survive. But if they do, they have been compelled to go very deep into themselves and find out what's really there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, when you look at, well, I mean, training in Jungian analysis is an incredible rite of passage, and any sort of work that brings us into connection with our path, our individuation, is going to cook us up in those sorts of very strong ways. But I was thinking that the call of the eternal return, the myth of the eternal return, was Eliade's way of putting it, and the sense of reconnecting to that, you know, this call, this myth, that somehow we've got to almost die to those redundant ways of being and doing and knowing, and to be sort of, if you wish, re-stimulated, renewed in the journeys that we go through. There's no guarantees that the path we take that will be pleasant or, as you said, even survive. But I think because of the global crisis we're in, naturally, if we don't pick this up and work with it, the more the globe goes, more the earth goes into chaos, the more we will panic and we'll be flipped into a rite of passage, one that we'll have no choice but to address. And Jung was always clear about that for each individual. Either face your individuation or be dragged along by the scruff of the neck, to paraphrase him. And I believe collectively the same will happen. If we keep ignoring this global crisis, we will be flipped. And enantiodromia, I think Jung called it, will be flipped to really see what this is about. So we've got an Earth Summit coming up. We've got the UN Summit in Paris this year. Let's see what happens. But I think our prayers and our thoughts and our good intentions can hopefully, you know, go some way in making our politicians really get to grips with this. But more importantly, it's the rite of passage that we take ourselves. And I think anyone who's doing this work, you know, would recognize that. And there's going to be a real calling for us to step up and find a path.
Well, you know, on that note, Mick, we have a caller, Peter from Santa Cruz. Go ahead, Peter.
Hello, Mick and Carolyn. Thank you for the delightful conversation.
Lovely. Hi, Peter.
Hi there. You said a couple things that I jotted down that I wanted to put together, facing our individuation, and that we're embedded, that supposedly that individuation is embedded in a deeper reality. Mm-hmm. And this seems to point to this deeper understanding that there's so much more to us than our humanity, and that daring to access that, or perhaps that's the rite of passage that we're in, is daring to be with this deeper embedded reality.
Mm. Yeah, I like that. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if we just think about how do we know the world, and we have our persona, the way the mask that we face the world and the sort of faces that we show everyone, the smiles, the frowns. Then we've got the ego, the sort of way we have an executive function in the world. So we manage our bills and our social relations and get out of bed to go to work in the morning. But then there's layers, you know, the shadow, the sort of more unprocessed sides of our unconscious. And then, of course, the self, with a capital S, you know, that we can grow in these transpersonal ways and connect to something far bigger, far greater. And I think you're absolutely right. That depth of connection is augmented a bit by the numinous as well. We have this sacred encounter, and it touches something sacred in us. You know, we don't necessarily become a teaspoon of water and poured into the ocean. Of course, we still retain ourselves in our everyday ego sense, but we also have a sense of becoming more. And I think Jung, at the end of his life, summarized it beautifully. He said at 84, he said just before he died, "I've lived for 84 years and I have no rounded answer to myself except that I'm connected to the trees, the clouds, the rivers, and the birds."
And that's, yeah.
Peter, do you have more?
Yeah. So there's that. For me, it's like, okay, there's this little human mind trying to find a way to grasp this grander reality, even to grasp that I'm connected to the trees and the birds and the dirt. is so far beyond the normal human mind functioning strategies, if you will. And I had a flip around a couple of weeks ago that was like, well, maybe we're doing this backwards. If in fact, as many spiritual folks will say, that we're
Are you there,
Hello?
Peter? Maybe we lost Peter for a moment. Are you there, Mick?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Well, yep. Looks like we lost him. Perhaps Peter will try again. Judith is calling from Colorado. Let's listen to Judith. Hi, Judith.
Hi, Carolyn. Listen, thanks for your conversation. I have a question for Mick. Do you have a sense of the new mythology that's needed at this time of global crisis?
Do I have a sense of it?
Yeah, do you have a sense of what that mythology would look like? And
yes.
What...
Now that to me is a fascinating question because, you know, I'd like to tie that question into the fact that we're at an evolutionary edge, i.e. we've never faced a crisis as big as this before on such a scale. We've had lots of myths that have inspired us from Greece and all other cultures and Maori cultures and North American Indian cultures, wonderful myths that teach us that we can go further and we can grow and we can connect in incredible ways. But we've never faced a crisis like this before. So none of us, and Barbara Marx Hubbard said this, that we've never really, we don't know what to do. So my sense of that would be we possibly have got to get to grips with this myth in a way that it might be like a leap of faith at first because, you know, we're getting to grips with it. But I think it's something like we have an idea now of we have a place in the cosmos. We are truly stardust. We are universal beings. And like I said earlier, we've had this incredible limited repertoire of exercising who we are. The menu's been quite bleak, persona, ego, in most of our education schools and workplaces. So the idea that we could be much more connected to a wider cosmos itself suggests something mythical, something epic in how we get to grips with that. And one thing I'm always cautious about is evolution is never prescribed. So I don't think we can say this is it, but I wonder if we dream into it together and connect with each other to have those stories, a bit like the elders in many of the indigenous cultures, to dream that myth into being and doing. That's my guess.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's very enlightening. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a great question. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks.
Thanks for your call, Judith.
Uh-huh.
And, Mick, I wanted to ask you, you know, some people call the work we do touchy-feely.
Yes.
But the physician-scientist Jung would have said that perspective may come from an undeveloped feeling function, or the underdevelopment of the feminine within us, whether we are women or men. And I'm wondering how often you're told that you're too touchy-feely and how you respond.
Well, I think most people think I'm a complete maverick anyway, so they don't even bother with touchy-feely. I think they think I'm slightly off the scale in most cases, and partly they're right. You know, I've never been one for overly conforming. But I think it's a really good question because that underdeveloped feeling function that you referred to, I think is the correlate to an overdeveloped thinking function, which is dominant in the world. And that really intrigues me, that of course, the touchy-feely comment is often an insult or a barbed comment or something that is seen less worthy. And I did a lot of training with Arnold Mindell, who you may well know, Arnie and Amy Mindell. And I was always, I love the way that they processed attacks like that. And I was thinking, you know, about, as we say, touchy-feely. I suppose my response to that would be, yes, I'm in touch with my feelings and I'd like to share them with you.
I love it.
That would be my initial response. But, you know, it's something as well that in a patriarchal, that it's like the hangover of a patriarchal way of engaging in life. We've had these very strong masculine structures and language that's dominated like that, this thinking function. I don't want to blame that only on men, but it's happened, and there's a sort of a resurgence or an emergence of that sacred feminine, which is so is happening and is growing and is so welcomed and, you know, so refreshing, that I think the words now we're seeing coming into psychology are compassion-focused therapy, and this is becoming more prevalent. And I'm really excited about this because naturally, well, you know, if we think about justice, if we think about how we treat ourselves, if we've got a rampant inner critic, or if we're judging others, that we take a more compassionate stance. So I think getting in touch with our feelings is absolutely right. And I don't see that as in any way flaky or weak. Quite the opposite. I mean, I'm really excited because today in Norwich, my city where I live, it's the saint day of Mother Julian of Norwich. And you may have heard of her.
Oh, yes. Well, all shall be well.
Indeed. Well, I used to go and sit in her cell. You know, she was an anchorite. And that meant she blocked herself in on the side of a church. And she couldn't get out, and so she had one window for receiving the sacraments, and she had one window for passing out her waste and receiving her food, and she would always have all the beggars and prostitutes coming to her window for counsel. This was a tough woman who dished out the most incredible compassion, who had the most divine revelations, and for whom had the guts and the tenacity to sit and spend her life blocked in a church. An anchorite. And, you know, I used to go and sit in her cell and just think to myself, wow, what a woman. This is amazing. That's tough, you know, and she was in touch with something. So whenever those sort of disparaging remarks come like that, I think I'd like to turn it around and say, yeah, I am in touch with my feelings. And what's happened in your life that, you know, you're finding that difficult?
Right.
Yeah. You know, without it being a fight or a challenge, but to, you know, if it comes in such a dissociated way as an accusation, you're touchy feely, pick it up and show that there's a process to that and there's something meaningful in it.
I totally agree with you. And we have just a few minutes left. I'm wondering if you have a forthcoming publication or what projects you're focused on at the moment.
Well, very exciting. I'm completing two book chapters at the moment, one on global compassion and one on doing with spirit. I'm writing a journal article, hopefully for the British Medical Journal, on sustainability and doing and health. I'm actually going to be writing a new book in the summer on unfolding human potential, which I'm really excited about. Going to go looking at some old Greek scholars and take some of their ideas forward. In 2 weeks, I'm talking at the Hay Festival. My book's been selected for the Hay International Book Festival, so I've got an hour interview there on stage, which is wonderful. And I'm speaking at a spiritual crisis conference in June the 12th. So lots of things to prepare for.
Well, you're certainly busy, and I'm so glad that you're doing this work in the world. I want to invite everyone to check out Mick's website, epiczoetic.co.uk, and his book, The Unselfish Spirit. And Mick, I thank you so much for being with us today, for giving us your time and your wisdom. Thank you for the work you're doing in the world. And thank you all, Lifeboat listeners. We'll be back again with you next week.
Carolyn, it's been an absolute pleasure, and I really have enjoyed it. And thank you for all your work. So I think your lifeboat is very much needed. I would just like to say, by the way, if anyone wants to connect with me on Twitter, I'm Mick Collins 20.
Mick Collins 20 on Twitter, right?
Yeah. Yes, you can find me on Twitter. Yeah, it's Mick Collins 20 or Mick.Collins 20. Anyway, one of those. But thank you, Carolyn. I've really enjoyed your show, and that's been a real pleasure to join you all and for your listeners too. Thank you.
Thank you, and have a wonderful day. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Thank you.
Like the father or the dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Love me, baby. Everybody knows you really do. Everybody knows you've been faithful, give or take a night or two. Everybody knows you've been discreet, but there were so many people you just had to meet.